Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes as we reflect on the Battle of Iwo Jima through the eyes of men who at this time 76 years ago were still contending for control of those 8 square miles in the Pacific. Before we hear Army Air Corps and Navy perspectives of the battle, let's hear from another Marine, Umbert Cantelmi.
I thought I was in a nightmare because shells were falling all over, artillery and mortars and everything. And if you didn't get down, you would probably be chewed up with the mortar shells, you know. There were so many that were killed that way with the mortars.
And probably killed not too far from you, on your left and on your right.
Yeah. There was bodies that were just dead Marines piled up for removal, you know. I don't know, for burial, I guess. And then a lot of the guys were, I don't know what they say. They said the first 72 hours, 2 out of 3 were hit, either wounded or killed.
Mm-hmm. That doesn't put you in very good odds.
No. You wonder when it's going to be. You mean it might be any time. So I just happened to be moving at the time the mortar dropped where I was standing or moving along. And like one time that the Japanese would launch these big rockets. They were rockets. They think they put them on. They had no accuracy, but they landed somewhere on the island, and they had to kill somebody. We were moving forward, and we're setting up for the night. We have these demolition guys. They come ahead of us and set these trip flares. So they hit these trip flares, and then you can see them silhouetted. But anyway, my squad leader said, just settle in this shell hole here. And he said he was going to come in with me, but till he got his squad set up. And then he comes by and says, you better move out of it because someone else is coming here. There was a little knoll in the back about 50 feet or so. And then I started digging the foxhole there. I was about probably knee deep, about ready to, you don't dig very far. You just got to get covered.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those rockets landed right in the hole. I was just left. So, and there's other, close calls. I had to watch a cave one time as they were moving forward and see if any, the enemy coming out of the caves or to watch. And after a while, they were getting up there a little way, so I decided I had to get up with them. Just as I'm out of range of I looked back and a mortar landed right there. So I just, it just happened to be, I guess the Lord was with me.
He is certainly not the only one who felt that way. The Iwo Jima memories we're going to hear next are from Jesse Dudley, who had trained as a bomber pilot but drew the task of becoming a personal pilot for General Mickey Moore, leader of the 7th Fighter Command. Dudley delivered the general to Iwo Jima in an unarmed B-24.
And we landed there at D+3. The Japanese were still fighting the Marines, and we got their attention when I landed with the B-24. I guess they hadn't seen one that close up before. But the 51s all landed ahead of me. We had a very uneventful flight. It took a few days to get there, but no problems whatsoever.
No problems whatsoever, but from what I hear, there were actually bullets flying across the runway when you put that B-24 down.
Absolutely, yes, it sure was.
Well, you got to question your definition of uneventful here.
I think they were awed by the sight of the airplane, and they just looked like they were kind of standing there with their jaws hanging. And, of course, I didn't stay very long. The runway was kind of short and temporary, and I ran off the end of it with the B-24, but it was nice and solid. It wasn't sand like most of the island. Made a quick turnaround and got back up to safety.
So you ran off the end of the runway. You said that very matter-of-factly. That sounds like that could be potentially hairy to me.
Well, it was it was mostly hard-packed dirt or whatever it was. Anyhow, I was a little surprised, too, that made a quick turnaround right there off the end of the runway and back. All the 51s that landed safely ahead of me, so.
Well, I think it's safe to say it's probably a lot easier to land a P-51 there than a B-24.
Absolutely, yes, absolutely.
I'm sure you're focused on just getting that plane down and accomplishing your mission, but as you were flying in, did you see anything that sticks with you today as far as the scene you were looking at and what was happening on that small volcanic island?
Suribachi. That was going to be home to me. We had our headquarters and our living quarters right at the base of Suribachi, which was still in the hands of the Japanese. It wasn't secured for quite some time after we got there. They had booby traps all over the island, like new lumber stacked up, and if you had tried to take it, it would have blown up, you know, things like that.
And so you were there just 3 days after that invasion started, and that's about how long the military expected it to last, but it lasted a lot longer than that.
It sure did, yes. Yes, the Marines were quite surprised on the landing, yes.
Well, and I imagine you saw quite a bit, even though your duties were not the same as what the Marines were doing. You probably experienced and witnessed some pretty vivid experiences there.
Oh, yes, yes. You know, we could see Suribachi, who was right outside our tent. As a matter of fact, we were also worried about nighttime. We were trying to dig under our cots, but the sand was so, I can't think of the word. In other words, it kept filling up the hole that we were digging. We did have some of our pilots that were killed during the night. The Japanese sneaked into the tent and slit their throat. So it was quite discomforting to live there.
That was pilot Jesse Dudley, who would later have the chance to count the Emperor of Japan as one of his passengers. If you want to hear that story, you can access his complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com, where, again, you can also sign up for the Best Defense Foundation Iwo Jima Honor Walk that will take place everywhere March 20th. 76 years ago, Delton Wally Walling, who had been at Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941, and survived 3.5 years of war since then, was watching everything unfolded at Iwo Jima from his ship just offshore.
And it's the first time that we saw the P-51 Mustangs.
Mm-hmm.
In the afternoon, here comes an awful roar of planes coming towards us about 50 or 60 feet off in the water. You can't see them.
But you can hear them.
You can hear them. And all at once we look out there, man, here they're coming. Well, hell, we're going for sure. And then they come by us and come up and make the rolls. And it's the P-51 Mustangs. Mm-hmm. See, the airstrip is secured. That's the first time that I saw the P-51 Mustang. Boy, I thought that was the hottest thing. Well, it was, up to the P-38 Lockheed Lightning. Boy, I thought that was the hottest thing. Well, it was, up to the P-38 Lockheed Lightning.
And I'm just imagining, as you describe that moment, that you hear these planes coming, you think you're about to die, and then you see that they're American planes. So it goes from the worst to the best in a split second, huh?
In a split second, yeah. 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 You see, I want to tell another story. Sergeant Bassalone, you know who he is.
One of the heroes of Iwo Jima.
He is a hero of Iwo Jima, but he was the first Medal of Honor at Guadalcanal. Because when the battle stopped in the morning at Guadalcanal, he had 32 dead in front of his pillbox. His gun is gone. His ammunition man is dead. He's the only one alive. Well, then we was able to hold 100. And then they took him back to the States and made a poster boy out of him.
Right.
He was the first Medal of Honor winner of the Marines in the Pacific War.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he was back there over a year or so, and he sold more bonds than any other man alive.
All the war bonds. He was the example that they used to sell
the war
bonds.
But all the time, he wanted to go back
right to
his men. So as we was coming, the squadron of ships is going to Iwo Jima. We picked him up at Guam. And he happened to come aboard my ship. So he was with us in the chief's quarters on this trip. So I got to know him real well on that little short trip. At Iwo Jima, we put him with his unit. He was on the third wave. The first two are dead. The men on the first two waves are dead or wounded. And when he came in with his, he saw that ahead of him and hollered to his men, "You're going to die if you don't run across that beach. Get across that beach. Don't stop. Do anything you can to get across." He hit them on the head. He called them bad names, everything, just to keep motivated to get them off there. him and another sergeant, and he got killed 500 yards in there right next to the airstrip. I knew that young man. He was a wonderful young man, Sergeant Bassalone. So at Iwo Jima, then they gave him the Navy Cross. Those kids that followed him off that boat that day would have followed him anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like you were ready to.
Well, I would have. See, I'm only laying off about 400 yards off the beach, and I'm taking back the casualties from that beach. That's why I had all of them aboard. I'm the first ship that took back the casualties at Iwo Jima.
So the Higgins boats, the LCVPs, would go from your ship to the shore to take troops in. They would also bring the casualties back.
If they could. Every boat could take them back.
Right.
Because they're under fire.
But there was a day there at Iwo where you guys received over 400 casualties back on your ship?
I had, by 10 o'clock in the morning, on the morning of the invasion, I had 400 back aboard.
Wow. What kind of shape were these guys in?
They're either dead or just any kind. You see, Mount Sarabachi was 3/4 mile away. And the whole side of that mountain, it faces the beach. And so over time of 20 years of them fortifying, they knew every foot of that beach. They had to calibrate it from every one of those holes up in that mountain.
All the caves and tunnels in Sarabachi.
That's right. So all they had to do was wait so many troops and kill them. And that was what was happening the day of the raid.
And you're watching this.
I'm watching. See, on the bridge, you got the big glasses.
Yeah.
And then afterwards, of course, I watched the flags go up on Iwo Jima.
And you said it right. You said flags, not flag. So you saw the first flag go up, and you saw it replaced by a second larger flag. Did that mean something to you at the time while you're looking from your
God.
Ship? Oh, my
God. You know, of course, we don't know how far on shore that the Marines have got. But when we see, we're making progress because now we've chopped off the thing that's given us so much damage.
Mm-hmm.
And right ahead of us was the little boat basin, and our tanks in those days are small stuff. So we're watching the advance. It took them 7 days and only a few hundred yards that they could get to that point.
Mm-hmm.
Because, man, those tanks would start up and go a few yards and blow bottom side up. It was so fortified that those men, I don't know how in the world they ever advanced on Iwo Jima.
I get the sense, and I could be wrong, but just kind of reading between the lines here as I listen to you, it almost sounds like watching the Marines on Iwo Jima was more difficult for you than what you saw December 7th.
Right. You see, I tell everybody, December 7th was bad, and we lost up to 3,000 people, civilians and military personnel. But every island in the Pacific, we lost more than that. Why don't we think more of these islands where these kids died than just Pearl Harbor all the time? But Pearl Harbor had to get us in the war.
And Pearl Harbor, you didn't know it was coming.
No.
But Iwo Jima, these are guys who have been on your ship that you're watching go to shore, and then you're watching them get killed moments later.
Yeah.
As you watch helplessly through those glasses. Right?
Yeah.
Do I have it right?
Yeah.
And there's a story. You picked up a light, some Morse code signals of a boat coming back to your ship?
That was opening day at Iwo Jima. That was one of those small landing crafts about 25, 30 feet long that had the big steel con in the center of it.
Uh-huh.
Just all at once. Here's a erratic lights flashing at me at our ship. And so I hollered to the captain below that this ship was trying to get hold. He says, see if you can find out what he wants. He finally got to me that he wanted to come aboard because his craft is sinking. I hollered to the captain. He says, get him aboard. So the guy came up there to me, and one man is hanging over the side dead. The other one, the one who was sending me the message, has got his other arm blew off, the armor that he uses for signaling. The left one is one he's sending the message to me, and he can't hardly send it.
So his right arm was blown off on Iwo Jima. The other guys on this boat are dead, and he's using his left arm to signal you while his boat is sinking.
And so he comes along. They throw the lines on the boat, and they rush down there and take off everybody. and the boat sinks right beside us, right there.
Wow. Out of how many people?
Well, there were six that they took off that was dead. There's only six or eight on any of those small boats like that. They're just a gunnery boat.
And I know you're not looking for attention on that, and you're not bragging, but if you hadn't responded to his messaging and taken action, he would have died.
Yeah, he'd have died.
You saved his life.
Well, I might have, but I just happened to see him, and we're the nearest ship, and I'm sure that if he'd have come close to anybody, they would have took him.
That man survived one of the more than 26,000 casualties in the Battle of Iwo Jima, which was unfolding 76 years ago right now. It's time for our final break, but when we come back, we're going to hear from a Coast Guardsman, an Army veteran, and yes, one more Marine about what they witnessed there. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.